we were really pretty bad. The 1990s for American distance running was almost a lost decade. There were only a few people that were competitive all at that international level.
Welcome to the Runners Connect Run to the Top podcast, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. So together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now, here's your host, Tina Muir.
Hello, this is Tina Muir. Thank you so much for joining me for the latest episode of the Run to the Top podcast brought to you by Runners Connect. I truly appreciate the time you're giving today to listen to the show when I know there's hundreds of other things you could be doing. Last week, I talked to ultra runner and nutritional expert Stephanie Howe. She talked about how to fuel up correctly for a marathon and beyond for maximum performance. If you missed it, be sure to go back and check it out. Now, if you've been listening for a while, you know that there is one guest in particular who I've been working on trying to bring on the show. I do love hearing his stories, and it seems every person I talk to who knows him just keeps reinforcing how great of a person he is. Well, today we got to hear from his longtime coach and mentor, Bob Larson. Bob has coached at almost every level of the sport, from high school all the way up to working with professionals. And he also set up the Mammoth Track Club, where both Meb and Dina Castor, that is, led the way. Bob is just as humble as you would imagine, and you will hear today that he gives some sneak peeks into what training involves, as well as what he believes makes Meb so special. But it's not just about Meb. Today we learn about a lot about Bob himself and his training philosophies, and I really think you're going to enjoy it because I know a lot of people have been requesting hearing more from different coaches and what they think. So if you're ready to dive in, after a word from our sponsor, we'll be right there. Multiple studies have proven running with music helps to improve performance. I have become addicted to my Jabra Pulse sport headphones, using them for almost every easy run. But shh, don't tell my coach. You will love these earbuds too, and you can enter to win a free set every month by visiting jabra.com/runnersconnect. Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast, Bob.
Thank you, Tina. I look forward to talking with you.
I'm excited for this. This is something I've been waiting for a long time. Okay, so we have a lot that I want to cover today, including you being the coach to one of the most loved runners in the entire running community. But I want to kind of start back in the beginning, where you initially began coaching at the high school and collegiate level. You were awarded Coach of the Year in 1995 for your work at UCLA. But based on all this kind of work that you've done throughout the different levels, I just kind of wanted you to talk a bit about that and the transition, what you enjoy about maybe each level of coaching, the high school, collegiate, and then professional runners, like what each one brings.
Well, I think I enjoyed coaching at each of those levels and set out purposely to do it that way. My high school coach at Hoover High School in San Diego, I was fresh off the farm in northern Minnesota and pretty clueless, and he recognized something in me very early and said that I should be a coach. And I always felt he had a great influence on me and steering me in that direction. So when I graduated from college, they turned the distance running team over to me as a graduate assistant, and they offered me a full-time position coaching at that college level, San Diego State. But kind of in honor of my high school coach and also enthusiasm for teaching younger people, I took a high school job and thought I would be there for 4 years. That was my intent, and then work my way back up to the college level. And I'm really glad I did that. You learn a lot coaching at the high school level. I encourage a lot of young men who want to get into coaching and say start at the high school level.
Why is that?
I think it's the developmental stage. When athletes get a little bit more advanced, you start thinking that a great runner or a great field event athlete or any event should have the maturity of the success level they are in the sport, and it isn't necessarily true. Hmm. You learn in high school that you can have a great athlete, but they need a lot of development and maturity and learning to help guide them to that level so they can handle success, they can handle the downside of losing occasionally and bad things happening, injuries and all of those things. I think that's the best way and the quickest way to learn it. And also in high school coaching, you wear several hats. Mm. You put on the banquets, you arrange the transportation, you help them with their schoolwork, you help them make decisions for what they're going to do in the future, what school they're going to go to. You're talking to the parents constantly. You're just totally connected in their lives and helping them to get better and better at every facet, not just the athletic component. In those situations, you learn very quickly what works and what doesn't, and everybody's different. But those are the same things you need at each level. And that's why I think some of the best coaches, at least when I was graduating from college, I realized most of the top coaches collegiately had actually also been very successful in the high school ranks. And so another reason why I chose to coach in high school, and it's Monta Vista and Spring Valley in the San Diego area. I was very fortunate because they hadn't won hardly anything. They're a fairly new school. I think they won one cross-country meet each year and one track meet each year. And we won the championship all 4 years I was there, 3 years undefeated in cross-country. And track, we came within a couple points of winning the county championship. So they really responded, and that gave me a lot of confidence that when I was coaching the San Diego State runners, they had responded to what I'd suggested we do, even though I just had graduated, and many of them were my teammates the year before, and the high school kids responded in term. And I was developing some ideas about what really worked with both motivation and with the workouts and the type of workouts that work with different individuals. So all of that was a great learning experience for me.
Mm-hmm. So then when, you know, you came in, you had that success at the high school level, and then obviously took it on to beyond that high school in college and professional. But you must have naturally had some kind of, I don't know, natural innate ability of understanding how things kind of came together. Do you think that coaching is a lot of, you know, what you learn from other coaches, or is there a part of it that you just naturally kind of see how it works together in your mind?
I think the biggest advantage as far as understanding the sport. I fortunately had some ability in a lot of different sports and in different events in track and field. So I never just coached distance running. I coached jumps and sprints and throws, everything at one point or another. And they're all related, and you learn something carry over from one sport to another. And when I did almost all those myself, even if I didn't compete in them, I did all the events and other sports too. So you pick up a little bit here, you pick up a little bit there. And one of the most valuable things I learned early on by going to clinics and reading what physiologists had to say about especially distance running, and going to clinics and listening to top coaches and other sports, John Wooden, for instance, in basketball. And I got to know John pretty well later. That there's so many different ways of coaching, you know, personality-wise, but also just how you work with people. And so that the answer always, to me, was come up with an individualized program. Certainly, when you have working with a lot of athletes at the same time, certain amount of it has to be a combination workout where most of the individuals are doing almost the same thing. But you, even within that, you allow individuals to make decisions, or you help them make decisions, or you nudge them in one direction or another. And that was so helpful in my coaching career, that knowing there wasn't just one way of doing this thing, and you're trying to figure out for each individual what makes them tick. Where would they really work hard? even though you might think that mile repeats is the very best workout for a particular day, if you have some guys that are not going to run hard in mile repeats that day, or they're a little bit fatigued, you might want to have them do 1Ks or even 400s. And I would always make that decision in a heartbeat when I saw people struggling, or you be patient. You just wait till they're ready, and maybe next year when they're a little bit older, or a day when they're more rested. So those types of things are, you learn through just applying it in a practical way to different groups of people. And mm-hmm. in high school, you have so many different personalities and backgrounds that you do have to adjust to have success. And so that was a wonderful, I think, experience for me, and helped me at every level beyond high school.
Mm-hmm. So I think what you're saying is, you know, anyone out there listening who is a coach, you know, and has their own group of athletes, whether it be high school, collegiate, or professional, or, you know, recreational runners, you really need to pay attention to, you know, each individual's strengths and weaknesses, and like you said, all the other things that come into it. You know, maybe they've had a few bad nights' sleep, maybe they have exams coming up, they're stressed, but you know, making those choices based on the individual at the time is really what makes the difference.
It does, and I would adjust it to the point where sometimes they wouldn't know even what the workout was going to be that day. They knew it was going to be, let's say, an interval training session. But sometimes I would wait to see what the weather was going to be like. It's going to be windy. I'd wait to see what they looked like on the warm-up. And then I might have them do a few 200s even and see if they were running 30-second 200s easily, or if they were struggling to barely get under 35. Hmm. I would adjust the workout. If, for instance, that was the day we were doing 800s, I would have them start really slow.
Mm-hmm.
Or I might at that point just say, let's try a couple. And if that doesn't work, we're going to do 400s today. Or if it's really windy, we might go with the wind on 200s and then go for a road run. So once you put it down, your workout down on paper, which you have to do, and you know, you want to stay focused on what you're trying to accomplish on any one given day. But because I knew through experience and talking with others how many different ways you could do this thing, it was easy for me to make those changes, and the athletes get really comfortable doing that. We go from slow to fast, and now you make exceptions when you get close to the end of the year where guys are cutting back on their volume, so they're pretty fresh every day. Then we would hold to a more exacting standard. You know, if we're doing race pace or a little bit faster race pace, because you know that, you know, by then the weather's good. Let's say track season, you get into the better weather, you count on that, and that they're fairly rested. And you let them know in advance a little bit, this is going to be a little bit of a test workout here. Let's see where you are. We're going to do 10 times 400 and timed rest, and we'll average that out, and we'll compare with where mm-hmm. you were previously. So you do all this stuff, but you have to be careful about hitting them too hard with test type of workouts or pushing them to the max. And where you see problems is if you have a lot of talent. Even as a coach, if you're trying to hold them back, many times there's competition in the group, and guys being guys and gals too are very competitive people at that high level. And if someone goes hard, they're going to go too. So I used to start out on some road runs, I'd run in front of them and not even let them know where we were going.
Oh, wow.
So we'd run maybe 10, 15 minutes, and then I'd stop everybody. We'd do some stretching for just 5 minutes. Let the guys who maybe ran a morning run and were a little bit sore or a little bit stiff could get warmed up at a slower rate. I wouldn't let the guys who had not run in the morning lead the workout. So then we take off again. I still wouldn't let them know where we're running until make sure that they're going on a slow pace. I did this at Monta Vista High School, Grossmont Community College, even at UCLA. Some of the early days, I could still run with them on the warm-ups. And then once I knew how everybody was feeling, then I said, okay, we're doing a certain loop and let them go. But sometimes the rule was, anybody that didn't run that morning could not lead that workout. I didn't always have that rule. It depends on how everybody was feeling. And then I'd either stay in the middle, try to stay in the middle of the pack, or cut across and watch them coming around and see if they're going too fast. And I'd give them a few words of encouragement or tell them to slow down a little bit. So it's not real restrictive in the workouts. They had to decide how fast and sometimes even how far, but I would guide them a little bit, and that's how they got. You want people to get better and better at making decisions about their own workouts, and because a lot of the running distance runners do is away from school, vacation, et cetera, when you're not allowed to contact them or work with them. So you have to teach them to be good at making these decisions themselves and not always getting out there and racing or not always getting out there and just jogging.
Yeah, no, that's great. And it sounds like, you know, you really played a part in shaping them as people. And like you said, making decisions for themselves, because, you know, you see so many college athletes or even, you know, recreational runners or everything. You know, we don't know how to make decisions for ourselves because it's always made for us. So that's good that you instilled that in them. And I'm sure that helped, you know, in many ways outside of just their running career. So you then, you know, worked with college athletes. You had a very successful coach there. And then you eventually kind of moved on towards post-collegiate, where you did set up Mammoth Track Club. And I'm not sure if you set up any training groups before that. But before we go into Mammoth Track Club, I just kind of wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts on the number of post-collegiate training groups? You know, do you think there should be more? Do you intend on setting up more? Or is there kind of enough for post-collegiate runners as there is right now?
It would be hard for me to say. I think probably the more the better. Mm-hmm. When we started this project in 2000, I think there were only about three in the United States that, you know, there were loosely organized groups in many cities and towns. But as far as really trying to get athletes to a higher competitive level or international competitive level, like we were trying to do, I think there's only three or four of us, a half dozen at the most. And now we have a few more. I think the quality of these groups is very, very important. And I think the quality keeps getting better. And, you know, we've exchanged ideas. We've spoke at clinics quite a bit. And to kind of give you a little background on this, Teen, is that when I was retiring from UCLA, I'd had put together the Hamul Toad training group in San Diego before I came up to UCLA. And we won the national cross-country title just with guys mostly from Grossmont Community College. And, you know, we beat the national level clubs. And that's in the film City Slickers Can't Stay With Me. And there's some funny portions of that because we were really low budget and taking on the top teams and back in Philadelphia and getting back there and all that is kind of a fun story. In fact, Matt Futterman writes for the Wall Street Journal, is real interested in doing a book just about that part of it.
Oh.
And he's interviewed myself and several of those athletes from that era. It was in the 1970s when we did win the national title with that group. But when I was getting ready to retire from UCLA, which I was doing a little bit early in my career, but one of the things I wanted to do was, you know, have the energy and the motivation to put together a training group again. And of course, Meb was graduating from UCLA and we needed a training group suited to his needs. So we decided to put one together in San Diego. His parents still live there, and we had the Olympic Training Center down there where we could do a lot of the physiological testing, put them on treadmills, and that's a wonderful group of scientists there, and they have access to other people, and they have all the equipment there, and they have a beautiful track. And so he stayed there for a couple years as a resident of the Olympic Training Center in Chula Vista, and we do a lot of our work out there. At the same time, over the years, I'd gone up to Mammoth Lakes, which is the perfect elevation, mm-hmm. 7,000 feet. So I felt like we could use Mammoth for altitude training. And then 2000, hardly anyone in the United States was seriously doing altitude training. There were a couple programs, colleges at the right elevation, but other than that, very few people were going to elevation, while all the medals, practically all of them at world and international Olympic competition, those medals were being run, won in the distances by people that were using altitude for training or they were living at altitude. So it was something I knew we had to do. And when we decided to use the San Diego facilities, I got in contact with some of the guys up in Colorado. And because I was looking for training partners for MEB down in San Diego, we didn't have a lot of really good runners there then like we'd had in the old days. So invited him to come down to Olympic Training Center and get out of the snow in the winter, and then called Joe Vigil, who was advising several of them and working with Dina Castor. And so I said, you guys ought to come down. And they did, and they just loved it. And Joe and I said, you know, if we really do this seriously, put together a training group, you know, we could get Americans back to an international competitive level. And because in 2000, we were really pretty bad. The 1990s for American distance running was almost a lost decade. There were only a few people that were competitive all at that international level.
Do you have any thoughts on why that is?
Excuse me?
Do you have any thoughts on why that is? Why that decade was kind of...
They had gotten away from volume training, starting interval training and intense training a little bit too early without doing the aerobic background work. And they'd gotten away from threshold training.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff that we were using in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s. A couple of my guys ran 210 in the marathon way back in about 1980, early 80s. Kirk Pfeffer ran, almost broke 210 in Fukuoka, you know, which was the big marathon in those days. And a couple guys were running marathons that really weren't marathoners. They just did it off of their 5 and 10 training. Steve Ortiz, when he was at UCLA with me, ran 2:13 in the marathon, you know, in his junior year. He was just kind of getting ready for track season. So we didn't think of the marathon as being all that a huge thing, which in the 1990s, it was kind of like you were a marathoner and then you were doing outrageous training, and there wasn't probably enough background before they started doing that type of training, because kind of the high schools and a lot of the colleges had gone to a lot of intensity, but not enough background or threshold training, in my opinion. And then, so in 2000, when Joe Vigil and I, and we were assisted by Running USA and Basil Honigman and other people that were helping him to put together a program that would assist post-collegiate athletes, because we didn't have too many effective ones in those days, maybe only one or two. So, and not everybody could go to that part of the country or qualified for that particular group. So it was wide open. It was something that we felt needed to be done. And the timing for us was perfect, because I'd been working with MEB and at UCLA. Joe was already working a little bit with Dina Castor, and you can't have two better leaders than MEB. And there was skepticism when we did this and going up to Mammoth. In fact, I remember people telling Meb, well, wait a minute, it's April. It's going to be cold up there. You're going to get sick. And, of course, we went up, and there's quite a bit of snow still in April up there. And just Meb, myself, and Phil Price. And we trained hard for 3 weeks. We wanted a little bit more time, but they were going for the try to break the American record in 10,000 meters at Stanford. And we felt, even though we didn't think Meb was really all that ready, we felt he should be in the race, give it a shot and see what he could do. And he broke the American record, 10,000 meters. He ran 27:13, and he wasn't real, real fit. He was fit, but not, you know, we would expect that.
Wow.
I knew he'd run his best, and I figured he'd run pretty fast. But when he got the American record, then it kind of opened everybody's eyes, and they were starting to ask, well, where's Mammoth and what were you guys doing? And we were training using the protocol that science told us would be effective. You know, I've done quite a bit of research. Joe knows altitude because he coached for years at Adams State and at altitude in Colorado. He grew up there, all of that. So, and taught physiology at Adams State. So, you know, he knows his stuff. And then, but I checked with other physiologists who had done research and looked at research that's been done around the country. And Mammoth, obviously, was just ideal to be at that elevation. And for extensive periods of time, you know, has served us really well.
Yeah, yeah. So then did you kind of know, even when you were coaching Meb at UCLA and when you were kind of initially working with him, could you tell that he was something special, or did that kind of develop over years of watching him? Or was it like initially the first time you kind of saw him run, you were like, saw something in him?
I saw something I thought was special because, like, you try to teach athletes to make moves late in races, especially if they don't have as much speed as maybe some other guys in the race. But even guys knowing they have to do that, a lot of times they won't do that. They're not disciplined enough mm-hmm. to do it. Meb, even when I saw him in high school, he did make that move in a 2-mile race. It was an invitational at UCLA, and I saw him make that move. And I don't think it was successful. I think he maybe finished second. But to be courageous enough and strong enough to make that move impressed me. And I wasn't going to offer him a full scholarship. I was the head coach at UCLA, and you try to get the best athletes for your assistant coaches, especially sprints and throwing events, because those guys can score in the NC2A usually really early in their careers, while a distance runner takes longer to develop. Because I was then just coaching the distance running runners. I coached the jumpers and the pole vaulters earlier, but turned that over to other coaches so I'd have more time mm-hmm. head coaching and the tasks that the head coach has to be aware of.
Yeah.
But when I visited him, Meb, and I hadn't seen him win a race in his junior year, but I finally decided that, you know, he did have special qualities, and a lot of it came from his family. And the family was accomplishing so much. They were refugees from Eritrea. He came to San Diego when he was a little kid. So it seemed that this was a really tough, hardworking, overachieving in many ways family. And his brothers and sisters were all great students. He was working really hard. And so, you know, I jokingly said I gave a full scholarship to Meb, which I just wasn't doing. We weren't giving full scholarships to hardly anybody, especially a distance runner. He had to come walk on and then earn the scholarship. But he scored in the NC2A his first year. He barely scored, but mm-hmm. he scored. And so it proves the point. And that's what our criteria was for at UCLA in those days, because you're limited on men's scholarships to only 12.6. It's, you got 21 events, so every scholarship is just golden. Mm-hmm. You are very careful about who you'd offer to, but he proved himself even his freshman year and got better and better. Now, as far as recognizing how much he would be able to do, you have ideas about someone who can get better, because I had other athletes in the past, distance runners, middle distance runners, who were as talented and in some ways more talented. What Meb brought was he had that drive. You know, he comes out and pushes hard. He doesn't compete in workouts, but he does everything right. And he does all the extra stuff. And for a young guy just coming into UCLA, that's unusual. And we had some great athletes on those teams. You know, off of one of those teams, a couple of years, we won back-to-back NC2As by record scores. One of those teams alone had 4 gold medalists in the Olympic Games. So we had so much talent that I'd seen what that level of athlete looks like and what they can do. Mm-hmm. And Meb brought all those qualities plus that endless drive. That it isn't like, you know, a few days hard and then he's going to back off. It's and he follows the workouts. To this day, he doesn't really need coaching. We've been together for over 20 years, and I still assist him, especially when we're getting ready for big races, especially when we go to Mammoth. But he makes those decisions, and he probably could have made most of those decisions even back at UCLA, but obviously he depended on me because I'd had some great other great distance runners who got to the very top and broke records. And so I had something to compare to. So mm-hmm. I spoke to him about the fact that he shouldn't be in a big hurry, that I thought he had a future. And I thought he could be a professional athlete at one point. He was getting beat by some of the college guys. He was getting beat by some of the high school guys. But also, he'd have his day occasionally. He won some NCAA titles when he was at UCLA. And so I figured because he had gone to school on a bus and, you know, had run at altitude when he was young, he wasn't a runner when he came over, that he didn't have all this background that many times you see East Africans have, that all of a sudden they're really, really good when they're very young. He had to work for it. But the advantage of that was because some of these guys had beaten him in college, other Americans, and in high school, that they weren't intimidated by him. So we felt he was the ideal guy to lead American distance running back to an international level, because if he could do it, if we took him to altitude, and the rest of the people were putting together around the group, and Dina, of course, and trained like we used to train, that we could get back to that level, as least we were in the 80s and 70s and 80s, where we were competitive internationally, and those marks still would be impressive. So mm-hmm. that's what we set about to do. And again, we had the two leaders who, when we got the medals, there was skepticism until we got two medals in the Olympic Games in 2004, and I was fortunate enough to be the Olympic distance coach and on the men's side. And of course, Dean and Meb worked out together along with Joe up at Mammoth again before we went to Athens, and we put time in on Crete, and they both got medals. We were the only country to get two medals in the marathon, so mm-hmm. I think that was the convincing, which we wanted to do. It wasn't just about our club, but we wanted Americans to get back to a competitive level. And that was the catalyst. From then on, you know, we could tell them what we were doing, but we didn't have to persuade anybody. Everybody, by then, let's say in 2000, hardly anybody was training at altitude over the Americans. And by 2012, I think everybody that was on the team did some altitude training or used it an altitude, some type of tent. So, and other good training groups, and, you know, not just us taking the credit for this, but I think we have to give Meb and Dean a credit that they did some things that got everybody's attention, and we got back on the right track.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Meb is, that's not the only thing that Meb, well, and Dina, both of them actually, you know, they've managed to, you know, stay on top of their game for such a long time. And, you know, you mentioned that now kind of almost everyone at that top level is doing some kind of altitude stint. And, you know, at that level, everyone is going to have a serious drive to do what they need to do. But what other things would you say that Meb possesses or does that kind of allow him to have been this good for this long?
I'm going to mention something, Tina, and before I forget, is there's two books on Meb. One mm-hmm. is Run to Overcome, which is kind of his history and the family history and through his UCLA days, et cetera, and a lot of inspirational information in there. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, Meb for Mortals and all his drills he does endlessly and still to this day are in there, but a lot of other good things and things we've talked about together over the years, even tactics and workouts and a lot of good stuff. So people can find it there. And then the film City Slickers Can't Stay With Me, reference to my country days on the mm-hmm. farm, Northern Minnesota, where my coach did talk me into running in high school. And there's quite a bit in there of showing Meb on threshold runs and quite a bit where I'm talking about threshold runs. And That was a big key to a lot of the success we had over the years. We were doing a little bit more of that at each level that I coached at, and to this day. As I said, Meb doesn't really need coaching at this point, but it's helpful with the logistics and getting around. And, you know, sometimes we just discuss, you know, what would be the best way of doing this or doing that in the workouts. But he makes the final decision, or, you know, as to how hard to go on a certain day or when to ease up. And he's adjusted on his own. I suggested some things right after Athens, and I think that helped him prolong his career. And that's by cutting down a little bit on the intensity days. And then a couple years ago, he figured out himself and kind of emulating some of the runners from the past that prolonged their career, like Joan Benoit, Samuelson, to, again, eliminate a little bit of more of the intensity, have fewer days, have a little bit more recovery in between. Those all helped him, I think, extend to now still being competitive at age 40. I think also because, you know, I cautioned him not to try to do too much in college, that this was a long process. He came along a little bit slower than some of the other guys they had had in college who probably could do workouts by their sophomore or junior year in college that he wasn't doing until maybe 2 years after college. But even when he was running at that level, a little bit more limited on the workouts that he was doing, he was still producing really good results racing. But for him to have the confidence that he didn't have to run huge mileage or run that much intensity and still be competitive, but not to get greedy and try to win every race, but just to be real competitive, and his turn would come and he'd win some championships. And I think that helped him to be able to keep improving after he graduated. And so many of the guys who did beat him in college might have been a little bit pushed a little bit harder in college. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't enjoy a extended professional career that he's been fortunate enough to continue to this day. So, but I think as much as anything, it's his willingness to do the drills, to do the stretching, to do the strength work, the nutrition, and to go to altitude for long periods of time and be away from friends and family. When we were up there for 5 weeks here recently before the Marathon Olympic Trials, it can be pretty tough. A lot of snow, a lot of cold weather. Yordanis, his wife, came up with three girls for the 1 3-day weekend. But other than that, we're pretty isolated up there. And that's mm-hmm. not everybody wants to do that after they've already won championships at the level he has, you know, and then he's had some injuries and he's been willing to do the cross training really hard. And that allows him, after being injured, even at UCLA 1 year, he lost a month of track training and road running by being in the pool every day. But he came out within 3 weeks, he was running pretty fast. If he had to start at ground zero, that makes it tough. It'd be the end of the season before he'd get going. And that saved him several times, and I think has helped him extend his career. And the amount of cross training, he's doing a lot of cross training these days, so he's not always putting in heavy mileage and trying to get the right balance. And, you know, he's so disciplined, and you know, a lot of this he's figured on his own, what's the best way to go about this.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like he's just got that balance so right. I mean, we use that word all the time, balance, but, you know, he does all those little things, like actually does the stretching, the rolling, the massage, the cross training, all those things that most runners have good intentions of doing, but may slack off, you know, a few times a week, whereas he consistently does them. But then on the other side of things, he's very dedicated, he's very driven, but it seems like he doesn't have, like you've mentioned, the intensity to where he kind of burns himself out, because he, you know, he's good at being patient and trusting that it's going to come together when it needs to. And, you know, that we always hear about how genuine and lovable he is as a person. And that it kind of just shows, based on what you just said, that, you know, even in college, you kind of held him back a little bit. And most runners probably wouldn't have handled that very well, kind of thinking you were sabotaging him. But he could see the big picture and see that, you know, yeah, okay, maybe he was not doing as much in training then, but it would pay off down the road. So seems like you've just managed to, you know, you guys just work so well together, that you've managed to, he's got that balance, and between the two of you, it just works out so well. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I think so. You know, part of this is he has the right temperament for all of this. And, you know, I saw that in that family, and why I offered a full scholarship eventually. They're very persistent, hardworking people that really can dedicate themselves to something and stay with it. And so Meb's a reflection of that family. And you see it in Merhawi, Keflezighi, one of his younger brothers, who got his law degree from UCLA and is now his agent and is doing just a terrific job. And Meb's surrounded by really good people because, like you've seen, you know, he projects as a really good person who's got a wonderful story and is a wonderful role model for our distance runners. And that's what we were hoping for, and continues to this day. I might also mention on, you know, the fact that he's been able to extend his career. It came out a few years ago, and now one of the sponsors for Meb is the Elliptigo, and it's where you stand up.
I have one. I love it.
Yeah, I do too. I have a vacation home down in San Diego on the beach, and I've got one in the garage, and I put a lot of miles in. But Meb has used that in the afternoons for his second workout, especially when we're not going really high, hard, but, you know, just putting in the boring aerobic buildup and base, and for him to get out, and he's on one side of the bay, I'm right on the bay, but he's right up above it on the hills, and there in San Diego. San Diego is just beautiful, and it's got great weather, and so he's going around or on the bay on this Elliptigo, and it's much more fun than you know, getting in a gym all the time and on a stationary bicycle, although, you know, we have to do that sometimes too. But he's willing to do stuff like that. Even if it wasn't Elliptigo, I know he'd get on a treadmill if he had to. We were on a treadmill up at Mammoth because he wanted to stay at altitude, but it was cold up there. And, you know, a couple weeks out, we realized it was going to be hot in San Diego. So we had to get on the treadmills, sweats on, and run to get used to the heat that we're going to experience in San Diego. And Denny's willing to do that. And, you know, at his age, that's a little unusual. Guys get tired of that constant routine of not being able to do some things they'd love to do, but, you know, have to take the time to just train. And he's still doing it. And that's remarkable.
Yeah, oh, he definitely is. And I love that you mentioned the Elliptigo. I mean, I knew Meb was an Elliptigo athlete. And the one time I did meet Meb, that was the one thing he said to me was, use that Elliptigo, you know, make sure you use it for your second workouts. And I'm a huge fan, but it was nice to hear him reaffirming that, you know, it wasn't one of those situations where he's just given something and kind of holds it when the cameras are looking. But it, I could tell it wasn't that. Like, he believes in it, and I definitely believe in it. So great to hear you mention that. Okay, and then just one other thing about Meb and his training. So as we've mentioned, he, you know, always performs when it matters. He's there when he needs to be ready. So how do you, when it comes to peaking him now, do you feel like you just know him so well that you've managed to get it or get him ready, you know, without even thinking about it, because you just know what workouts he needs to get at a certain point? Or has he kind of taken over now with knowing, you know, what he needs to do and when?
He makes those key decisions about the workout. It's the same program we've used over the years, but it's adjusted, as I said, age adjusted a little bit, so he gets a little bit more rest in between. And if he's not feeling good, you know, he's just going to take a day off, which you want all athletes to get to the point where they don't feel guilty if they feel they need an extra day or two. When mm-hmm. they're younger, you almost need coaches to make that decision for them. Otherwise, they do feel guilty and would Absolutely. Be tempted to go out and run. But Meb would, in an instant, he would decide to cross train or maybe even take the day off if he's not feeling well or, you know, feel like he's trying to avoid getting sick or making a sore muscle into something that's going to be chronic for him. So he makes great decisions that way. And as far as getting ready for these major competitions, yes, we've done it so many times that we have great confidence that if workouts, especially the threshold workouts, are going well. And
so
we
what
use,
do you mean by that, just in case anyone doesn't know? Well, what does that mean to you?
Threshold run would be you're running at a pace that's your heart rate is high enough, you're pushing hard enough in the run that you could talk and answer somebody, but you wouldn't want to extend a conversation because you're working pretty hard, and especially during the build-up phase, we're at altitude, it's at least 7,000 feet, sometimes higher, going pretty hard. And for younger athletes, usually we think in terms of trying to extend it as least 20 minutes. But for Meb, you know, and someone like Dina, Meb especially, we've had him go as much as 17 miles. But for a build-up for a marathon, we'd probably be doing 8, 10, 12, mm-hmm. 14 miles at a pretty hard pace. And again, it's in that the film and showing him, we would have a bicycle. I used to pace him on a bicycle on some of those runs. Still do it occasionally, but we have other cyclists that'll help both in Mammoth and down in San Diego. And so gets out there, gets behind the bike, and they go pretty hard. And that's one of the most effective changes or ways to change and make mm-hmm. you stronger is to run those threshold runs like that. And it's been the bread and butter of many of the workouts and training programs, you know, we've had at different levels all the way through. And when they can go really well on those threshold runs and extend them, we know, and he's had several weeks of being able to do that and the other workouts too, but especially the threshold runs, when he gets strong on that, we know he's going to have a successful race. And then mm-hmm. you're not tempted to keep training hard those last 2 weeks or push too hard on one of those last few workouts. That you see people are still vulnerable to doing that. And he doesn't need me to caution him, but I certainly, you know, at my age and seeing so many disasters, not with Meb, but with other people, you know, he probably gets tired of me saying, okay, now you're really ready. Be sure you, you know, we get to the starting line healthy. You don't have to push anymore here, but I don't need much of an argument. He's thinking the same thing. And and that's where confidence comes in. I think two people together talking about that, just reassuring him that what I see, you know, and then we're talking about tactics and, you know, saying that half those guys are going to mess this up and not be ready. So you don't have to worry about beating a whole bunch of guys. All you got to do is beat a couple guys and you're going to be on the team. And that's how the Olympic trials came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it worked for him. That's great. Really cool to learn more about that. And do you think those tactics, you know, that using the threshold runs and kind of when you get those indicators that you are ready, you know, not pushing too hard towards the end, do you think that can be applied at every level, kind of from high school to college to recreational runners who are trying to run, you know, a Boston qualifier or even just like a, you know, a 4 hour, 5 hour, 6 hour marathon? Do you think it can be applied at every level with just, you know, kind of believing in yourself once you get those indicators that you're ready for your kind of goal pace?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I don't think you're going to reach that highest level of your potential unless you, the first thing has to be, you have to decide how many, much volume you're going to do and what part of the year. You have to get that right first. And if you cheat on that, then even though you're going to get faster and faster at interval training, a lot of times you can't get that out for a great race. So you got to get that background in, and then you introduce that, the threshold runs. And if you get that threshold really high, that allows you to run almost any distance at closer to what your potential is for any one season. And in high school, I had the guys run probably not no more than about 4 or 5 miles. We had a loop that was about 4 miles, and they would push through that pretty hard, and I'd run it with them. And we found that, you know, right away we were beating everybody else. And not that some of the other teams were doing some of that, but we were doing a little bit more. Obviously, with a professional runner, even at UCLA, we were going longer distances than we were with the high school group. But it just extended as the guys get older. And you want to run those hard, but you don't want to let the guys race. If you let them race all the time, you're going to end up with one or two distance runners. You're not going to end up with a whole team. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I'd have to separate those guys or make sure they weren't running too many days of the week together. You can put some of the weaker runners with stronger runners on certain workouts, even interval training sessions or some of those tempo or threshold runs. But you have to separate them too, and make sure that the weaker guys are not getting eaten up by your strong runners. And so it's a juggling thing. But with Meb, of course, it's just with the bicycle leading him, so it's not a temptation. He was usually not competitive in workouts anyway. He was always trying to help the other guys on the team get stronger. A couple times at Mammoth, he went pretty hard when Ryan Hall was working out with our group, and Abdi was up there for a while. And once in a while, you'd see Mib go a little bit harder than he normally would. But usually he would then adjust it the next couple of days and be careful. So he's just really savvy about how to go about these things and not let his ego get involved in a workout when, you know, ego time is when you get in a race and you got to do it right. So, you know, he was so easy to coach at every level, and now makes these decisions on his own, and I just assist him a little bit, and it's just a nice time for both of us, and we're really enjoying. Obviously, last couple of years, I was just thinking in terms of, he makes another Olympic team. My goodness, what a wonderful, wonderful thing that we would be so blessed. So the only thing I was hoping is, you know, he didn't get sick or didn't get injured. If he wasn't, I just felt he was smart enough and strong enough, he was going to make the team, and that's the way it turned out.
Yeah, and it was fantastic. Such a great race to watch, and just, you know, I think everyone was happy for him, which is just, you don't see that very often where people just, you know, really genuinely want someone to keep succeeding. And I saw the other qualifiers also called him a hero, which is so applicable. Okay, so I have one more question for you, just about you, but I just want to pause for a second just to thank our sponsor. Depending on where you are in the world, summer or winter is coming. We only have a few precious weeks of this ideal running weather before the mental battles begin. Music or podcasts can make those long training days much easier, and I love to listen to 90s music to get me through the really tough parts. Jabra Pulse is the wireless sports earbud that was designed with runners in mind. Yes, that means no slipping out of your ear on those hot summer days, especially with the customizable in-ear pieces. It even has an accurate in-ear heart rate monitor, so you can use that to make sure those easy days stay easy. Yeah, just like you promised. I love mine, and I've run with musical podcasts more in these past few months than I have in the rest of my life combined. That is how great these are. Runners Connect listeners can get exclusive offers and enter to win a free Jabra Pulse headset by signing up at jabra.com/runnersconnect. That's jabra.com/runnersconnect to start your journey, or buy the Jabra Pulse at your local Best Buy. Jabra, this is where it starts. So you have won, you know, plenty of awards for your contributions to track and field. You've, you know, been called the greatest coaching guru ever, and you have, you know, just all these awards and all these, you know, people saying great things about you. But what is it about running, or just about watching running, coaching running, being around the sport that you love and are just so passionate about?
Well, Tina, first, let me correct something. Obviously, I don't think I'm the greatest coach.
No, I know you didn't say it.
And I don't think other people do either. I hope I'm in that group of people who would be considered having contributed to a wonderful sport, contributed some good ideas. I thank those that shared their ideas with me, too, and especially Joe Beal and a lot of other coaches I worked with over the years. So I've been very fortunate to be around good people and have the enough common sense to know who the good ones are and wise enough to know that, you know, I'll never know it all and look forward to even learning more in the years in the future. And then obviously when you compliment a coach, you're really complimenting his athletes. You're complimenting Mib and all those wonderful guys that I coached over the years that were willing to work so hard and then just lay it out all out on the line in a race. And it's just, you know, I'm always overwhelmed when I think how hard these guys were willing to go, you know, to be successful. And that's why I'm in this position. And obviously this time of my life, to be able to still be active in a meaningful way in the sport is a wonderful thing. And I think that, well, if we're looking at the highlights or the greatest moments and why I enjoyed the sport so much, it's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I think of it, some of the best moments for me in this sport are being down at my vacation home, as I mentioned, in San Diego, looking to make sure the tide is out and running along the beach on the edge of the water, barefoot with a pair of shorts on. Mm-hmm. And when I was in college, I'd run down there in the soft sand, the same place, same beach, because I had stress fractures and nobody knew what stress fractures were. Just told me to run through it. And of course, that was a disaster until I couldn't run anymore. And then after Wade. And then I found out if I did that for quite a while, for a season, 3 days a week, ran at least 8 miles in that soft sand, that then I had no more lower leg problems. And so discovering some of these things and being able, having been injured a few times myself, because we were in the dark ages, we didn't know hardly anything about training. We would just train until we got injured. We knew we could break records, but we couldn't stay uninjured. So that experience has been very helpful for me in understanding that process when you get injured, how devastating that can be for an athlete, but also how to overcome that with cross training and being more sensitive to those people that could possibly get injured, to adjust those workouts, to encourage them to believe they still can come back from those. All those things, if I can contribute something to the athletes I'm working with and kind of pass the word to other people, especially the altitude training that Joe and I and Mib and Dean and other good people in our group. Terrence Mahan was one of our athletes, Jen Ryan's husband in our training group. He went on and took control of the group for a while up there at Mammoth. Now it's Dina and Andrew. Mib and I still go up and others. But to see that have success, that group have success that we put together, the Mool Toads put together in San Diego. There's a bunch of them still running. A lot of the old guys that won that championship are still putting in a few miles like I am. All those things. I'm very fortunate because all of them touch me in a very positive way, and to have had a bit of an influence in with so many different groups and different environments and different personalities, and to have the opportunity to work with them, you know, it's really a blessing.
So. That's great. Let you answer the phone there. I will not be editing that out because that was such gold what you were saying there, and I just loved it. And so I apologize to our listeners, that was the phone, but at least that shows that this isn't completely manufactured here. Okay, so one, I will tell our listeners to make sure you do check out the show notes at runnersconnect.net/101. to check out the show notes for Meb's two books and also for the City Slickers documentary, Can't Stay With Me, which is actually all about Bob. And, you know, that's a pretty cool thing to have about you. And I definitely encourage people to go check that out. So, Tina, Bob, were you going
to
say something?
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have to tell you something quickly.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I tried to discourage them from making that film. Robert Lusitano, who ran at Monta Vista High School, Grossmont College with Emul Todes and at UCLA, knew a lot of this stuff, and he wanted to do a documentary, and he'd never done one before. He had been successful in other businesses, and so, but he was persistent. I strongly suggested several times he'd not do this, but he did. It took 4 years to do it. Quite a bit, obviously, is about Meb, especially, you know, preparation and it kind of ends with him winning Boston, but everybody ended up liking it. So, you know, I was dumb to even think that it wouldn't come out well or people wouldn't be interested. But I'm really grateful to Robert. I have no financial interest in it. Robert isn't all that interested in necessarily making money, although he'd like some reimbursement, you know, by selling a few tickets. But more than that is he just wants people to see it. And he's got it listed under coachboblarson.com. Mm-hmm. So people can go there, and there's a web page on where it'll be shown next. And it'll be shown in Jacksonville, Florida, middle of March, a couple of days before the Gate River race. And I'm going to go down there. They're bringing me down. They want me to kind of give them some background on the film. So we're really having fun with it. It's been shown at most of the major theaters. And Robert likes people to see it in a theater because he really got some great photographers. And his sister, Donna, helped him. And she's really well known in Hollywood. She's worked with the History Channel and a lot of other projects. And so it ended up really being a quality thing. And so at this point, I'm proud of what Robert did. Obviously, it's very complimentary to me. In fact, I've told him if he could edit out a lot of the Bob Larson stuff, it would be a terrific film. But some people can put up with that and watch the rest of it. And you know, it's could be done by a lot of coaches and a lot of teachers who, you know, have found ways to be effective with young people. And but he chose to do it about me, his old coach, and hopefully it's a positive message about track and field and athletes and athletics in general, that, you know, I don't think we can ever have too much of that as a message to everybody out there.
Oh, absolutely. And I look forward to checking it out myself. And if you could send it over towards Lexington, Kentucky, that would be great. Then I will go see it in the theaters. Oh. I'm not sure how realistic that is.
I'll tell Robert. There's ways of doing it on the website, actually.
Okay.
That a lot of coaches who have seen it said they want to show it in their community. So,
yeah,
you know, and that's how it's happening down there. Richard Fannin, who is the director of the Gate River, I guess he saw the trailer on the website and decided he wanted it in his community. And some really good people that I very much respect have had said wonderful things about it. They showed it at the U.S. Nationals in track and field last year. Anna saw it, and I didn't realize till recently, tweeted out to everybody, says, it's awesome. So you can't get a better endorsement than Vin Lanana saying, you know, something that complimentary. So I've been a little bit hesitant to talk about a film that's much about me, but when I realize it is a positive message and Robert put so much time and effort into it, hopefully a lot of people will enjoy watching it, including you at one point.
Yeah, I definitely will. And I hope you do take it in, even though you're showing you're just about as modest as Meb is, you know, for you to have had such an impact on so many people's lives, I hope you do see, you know, how many lives you've touched and how much you've changed the running world. So you definitely deserve it. So soak it all in and enjoy it.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I just have the final kick round, which is just a few quick questions, you know, nothing long, or you don't have to say as much or as little as you need, but let's start with the greatest advice you've ever received. I'm interested to hear this one.
In coaching in general or in life?
Anything, whatever you like, life or running.
You know, for parents out there, this maybe has stuck with me a lot. When I was young, very young, my mother would say, "Oh, you're ambitious." And she would say one other thing. She said, "You really have good common sense." Mm-hmm. Now, I kind of doubt that I was very ambitious when I was really young or had good common sense. But just my mother telling me that, I think it planted a seed that when you're the common sense part of it always comes in handy and you kind of rely on that. And then just the ambitious part of it, you say you almost have to live up to that when your parent tells you that. And just a message to parents that positive reinforcement of maybe some little thing you see in your children or mm-hmm. coach sees in an athlete that you mention that occasionally and maybe that sticks with them and they try to be that person that you're describing or complimenting them about. I think that was real important. And then I mentioned as far as running is concerned, you know, trying to learn as much as I could about the sport in general in mm-hmm. many ways, but realizing there's a lot of ways to do this. And once I realized that, being able to adjust workouts and having the confidence that I could adjust workouts to many different people, and there wouldn't be just one way of doing this thing. I think that was really important and helpful in my career.
That's great. That's great. Very helpful. Okay, your favorite running book. If you say one of Meb's books, you have to pick between them.
I'm going to mention four books, Tina.
Oh, geez. I'm not sure I can allow that one.
I mentioned both of Meb's books already. But in addition, I really liked Born to Run.
Yep.
You know, and obviously some things in there are exaggerated a little bit, but in a fun way. And the characters in the book and how it was written and being down there in Mexico and all that stuff, it's fascinating. And I really mm-hmm. enjoyed that. Another one is, of course, Hildebrand's book on
Unbroken.
Unbroken. and I saw the film, too. I went to the premiere here in Los Angeles. And that's not necessarily a track book, but mm-hmm. Louis Zamborini was something special, mm-hmm. not just as an athlete, but as a person to survive mm-hmm. what he did. And boy, you can't go wrong with any of those books. They're all inspirational.
Well, you'll be happy to know that I actually did interview last year. I interviewed not only Christopher, who was fantastic and so much fun, but I also did interview Laura Hillenbrand on the podcast as well. So I've had both of them. Can endorse both of those books too. They are great, great reads. Okay, what would your advice be to a new runner?
I think to really start extremely easy. For some people, I think it's even just walking fast or jogging and walking, because if you haven't been doing this, no matter what your age, even young kids, you can develop Achilles tendonitis. You can develop mm-hmm. shin splints. You can develop all kinds of problems, knee problems early on. And then a lot of people just drop out, but start so easy that you stop that particular workout far before you're really testing yourself. Mm-hmm. I think that's so important. And again, walking and jogging is the way. And then if you're a little bit older, if you're an adult, and especially if you're 50s and older, you know, Meb's age. Sorry.
Almost.
I should laugh at that, but Meb's 40, but he is masters. And I jokingly asked going into the Olympic trials, what time does the Masters race start? And taking advantage of the fact that here's an old guy and wanting him to be aware that he was going against young guys and putting a little bit of pressure on them. But getting back to if you're just starting out and you're in that 40 plus age especially 50s and 60s, I think you should get a physical. Well, I know you should get a physical before you start stuff. And then still just walking and then jogging a little bit and going from there. And there's a lot of good running groups, you know, local running groups. And it's so much easier to run with a group occasionally, even if you only do it once or twice a week, and then they exchange tips and stuff like that. So just getting out and getting going is the biggest thing, and just don't overdo it. So if you overdo it, then you're going to quit too. You get tired of it. Figure out something you can do and gradually build it up over a long period of time. Something you'll stay with. That's distance running takes a long time. And so you want to be able to do a workout you can live with and enjoy over, you know, a long period of time, not just a quick fix for whatever you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we've kind of learned that a lot through what you've talked about today. That's kind of reinforced that in our minds. And finally, your favorite running product.
Running product. Well, I mentioned Elliptigo.
Yeah.
Those I really like. I think there's a lot of essential things that we have access to them. Not everybody does, but especially in that upper Midwest where I grew up. And then when we're at Mammoth, those treadmills really come in handy on really bad weather days. We can drive down to 4,000 feet within about 30, 45 minutes. So we can get out of the weather sometimes, but also getting ready for the heat of Los Angeles, we had to be on a treadmill indoors. And so that was really valuable for us. There are a lot of other things out there. You know, the watches now that are little computers, MEB is sponsored by Epson. It keeps you on in the right direction. It reminds you, you know, and the heart rate monitors that are built into some of these. And I think all these are good. I'm pretty simplistic or minimalistic in some ways. I still like that, as I said, run along the beach with a pair of shorts on. That's what attracted me to the sport, is just going as hard as you can, trying to see if you can beat somebody else and endure, you know, the agony that eventually towards the end of whatever run you're doing. I always enjoyed that. And then, you know, some of these other things sometimes complicated, but if you're going to run at the highest level, then a lot of these things are really helpful to you. And the cross training has really been effective in helping Mib continue his career into his 40s now.
Yeah. Great. Okay, Bob, well, thank you so much for your time. This has been great to kind of peek in your mind and kind of see a bit behind the scenes of Mev and, you know, the man who made him who he is today. So thank you so much.
Well, be careful with that, Tina. He's his own man, but
I know, but I'm sure you had a huge influence.
The old coach, that's all.
You definitely did. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tina. Enjoyed it.
Well, that just goes to show once again that good people just seem to attract other good people into their life. Bob is perfect proof of that. What a mentor Mev has, and you can see why they work so well together. Remember, you can still enter to be one of 10 winners for a Runners Connect stretching, kettlebell, or foam rolling program, and I'll put a link in the show notes for that at runnersconnect.net/101. We will be announcing the winners at the end of April. If you enjoyed today's episode, I would ask you to please consider leaving a review about the podcast. I'll give you all the instructions you need, as well as all the other podcast-related information, on our podcast page, which I will put a link to in the show notes, or you can also access it at runnersconnect.net/run-to-the-top. Next week, I'm going to have You Can Run Pain-Free author and my friend, Brad Beer, back on the podcast, this time to answer your most common questions, all about injuries. So let's see just how much I can read your mind. Until then, have a great week.